CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
Well, in this week's CFO Radio News, we have an article published by CFO.com, and it's entitled "Switch to Nonprofit Offers CFO Less Pressure, But It's Still No Vacation." And this is an article that is about Promotional Products Association CFO Bob McLean. He was surprised to learn that he had to master many new industries after moving from the for-profit side into the non-profit world. And this is an article from CFO.com in a series of articles about two CFOs who've made the shift from public companies to not-for-profit associations. And in this one, Bob McLean tells the story of his transition. After a long finance career at both public and private companies, McLean has been CFO of Promotional Products Association International for about 3.5 years. His most recent previous CFO role prior to this was QI Systems, a startup technology company that made smart card readers. And this is what he said. "I was looking for a new opportunity and connected with PPAI through my network. I was impressed with the organization's professionalism, though I was concerned that because I'm in my 50s, it might be hard for me to go back into private enterprise after taking this job. On the other hand, this particular not-for-profit organization is profitable, which is different from many of the for-profit companies that I've worked for," he said. "That had some appeal, and PPAI is a good size for an organization with about $15 million in revenue. Not-for-profit jobs don't have the equity upsized, but I had those in some of my previous jobs. The opportunity was there for me to make a killing. But in the last few equity plays I had, this didn't work out, and they're paying me very well here. So it was a good move for me," he says. "The biggest difference from a public company is not having the intense pressure to immediately report financials, whether you report quarterly or monthly. Before I got here, there wasn't even a monthly close," he says. "But even now that there is, whereas at a public company you have to report to the board by about the 10th of the month, how we're closing, and here we are closing and reporting the previous month's financials at the end of the current month, so by the 30th, 31st. The pressure is also not there to always exceed your targeted number. We don't have outside shareholders and we don't have a bank, so there are no loan covenants. I was aware of all that coming in," he said, "and in fact I thought I might be on vacation for the rest of my career compared to my previous work. But it really hasn't worked out that way," says the article. "There are still a lot of accounting issues and also member issues. We have a top 50 trade show in Las Vegas, one of the largest trade shows in the country. Annually, we have a magazine, and the trade show is annual. We have a magazine for which I'm the publisher, and we do live education events like conferences and webinars. There are a lot of different business lines. That's what surprised me the most," he said. "I didn't fully realize I'd have to learn so many different industries or the newness and complexity of that on top of selling memberships and sponsorships. It keeps me very busy. The profit we turn from all those activities goes into return reserves," he said. "We have a rainy day reserve, a building reserve fund, and reserves for the future. That in itself can become a concern, though. When a non-for-profit is very profitable, you can get pushback from your members. They might start saying you're charging them too much for dues or you're making them pay too high a fees for your booths at your trade show. It's a nice position to be in, but not a normal one for a not-for-profit. When we get to a certain level, we can start to look at investments or commitments that don't generate financial returns, but do generate members' benefits. For example, we spend money to lobby Congress about promotional products. A lot of people view them as trinkets and throwaway items, but they're actually a very effective advertising media for us. We don't get a penny out of that, but it sure does help the industry, which is arguably a long-term investment for our association. Well, thanks go to CFO.com for allowing us to use that article. And today, I'm pleased to say that we have Melissa Beard as our guest on CFO Radio. Melissa is CEO and Executive Director of Engineering World Health, a nonprofit organization established in 2001 by Drs. Bob Malkin and Mohamed Kiani, with the aim of improving the technical infrastructure in hospitals in the developing world and ensuring access to modern healthcare. Today, EWH is the largest organization in the world dedicated to post-donation medical equipment repair, maintenance, and training. Well, prior to this, Melissa was the executive director at North Carolina Society of Surveyors, and previous to this, she was outreach coordinator at Prevent Blindness North Carolina. Melissa has an MPA degree in community health administration from East Carolina University. Well, welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lorraine.
Well, Melissa, you're calling in from North Carolina, and we're glad to have you bright and early this morning. what I would like to do, just to get a little bit of the dialogue going, let's talk a little bit about you. And our first question to all of our jobs, to all of our guests, is what their first job was. And we look at the very, very beginnings of your life and your career, and it's a little bit of a candid way to have some fun on the show. Some of our guests have said that they were a gymnast. One of our guest said that she was a gymnast and earning as much money at the age of 13 and 14 years old, and it took her to be 30 years old before she made the same level of money. Others have said they sold frogs at 5 years old. One of our guests said she sold big frogs for a quarter and little frogs for 10 cents, and that she felt that that was her first lead into entrepreneurism. So, Melissa, what was your first job?
My very first job was at the Great American Chocolate Chip Cookie Company, and I was told that I would eventually get sick of the cookies, which sadly never happened. But so that was my very first job, and that was in high school. And I'm sure, like many other people, I dabbled a little bit in babysitting and tried to make money off that. Mm-hmm. And went on.
Was
to
that
work
while
for...
eating the cookies?
Well, it really helped when you took the cookies to the kids. You had instant friendships that way.
Oh, that's funny. And, you know, that reminds me of a story, and I'm telling a little bit of a personal story. But my mother, she's passed away now, but many, many years ago, her first job was in a cookie factory. And the way it worked then was that you could eat the cookies. I guess there was some kind of health warning process that took place, but you could eat the cookies, and it would be deducted from your salary. And the story goes in the family that a couple of weeks successively, the company boss called her mother at home because she was eating more cookies than her salary, and they owed the company money.
That's great. Yeah, my particular position, I would say, made me very popular with the teenage boys that worked in the mall, because as a standard, when somebody would make one of the cookie cakes, you would cut off the rough edges. Mm. So you would have fairly thick cookie crumbs or leftover cookies that we could bag up and just give to our friends. And so you can imagine that made me a pretty popular girl, to have all the boys coming to get the chocolate chip cookie leftovers too.
So let's do a hop, skip, and a jump. You are now CEO of the largest organization in the world dedicated to post-donation medical equipment repair, maintenance, and training. And that's that we're going to learn about your organization. But bring us through from cookies to here. Bring us through.
Well, It's an unusual path. At the end of my resume, this position makes sense, but along the way, it doesn't seem like there was much of a method to the madness. While getting my master's in public administration from ECU, I was concentrating in public health, and as part of that particular degree, had to perform some sort of internship. At that point in my life, I had lots of friends in New York City and thought, well, that'll be a fun place to go. I'll do an internship there. I'll send out some resumes. Much to my surprise and amazement, I was given an internship at the United Nations Fund for Population Activities, which is to this day one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever had. I'm thrilled to have been a part of that organization. It was a very humbling experience. So that was actually my very first position, was with the UNFPA, or first position in public health. Through contacts that I made while at the UNFPA, I left there a couple of years later to take on a position with the National Office of the American Lung Association, working on a project that was being run by the Heart Association, the Lung Association, and the Cancer Society under a CDC grant called Project Assist, which was the American Stop Smoking Intervention Study, and worked with the Lung Association for about a year, and followed a boy back down to North Carolina with the expectation that we would wind up getting married and riding off into the sunset, but alas, that wasn't to be. So I took over the ASSIST program for the State Office of the American Cancer Society and worked with them for a number of years, promoting stop smoking interventions and working with children to keep them from starting smoking, did a lot of educational efforts and a lot of governmental affairs and lobbying. You can imagine lobbying against any kind of tobacco product in North Carolina is a bit like banging your head against a wall in those days. So that was a very challenging part of my career. I left there to take over a vision screening program at a statewide level for Prevent Blindness North Carolina, which I also count as one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. It was a wonderful program run in all of the school systems in North Carolina to ensure that children could, you know, see what they were learning. There's so many instances of children that sit in the back of the classroom and they're dubbed as slow learners, and it's not that they can't read, it's that they can't see. So we were able to help a number of students get glasses and help improve their grades and their education on the whole. From that, I did a complete left turn and became the executive director for the North Carolina Society of Land Surveyors. Worked there for a little over 6 years, working with their education programs, with their government affairs, running their committees, and working heavily with the board. It was a great leadership experience with a wonderful group of men and women. And at the end of the day, I saw the ad for Engineering World Health, and it seemed like a great compliment to all that I'd been doing. While I was in the association world, I had genuinely missed being aligned with the cause. I had always wanted to do something at an international level. I speak several languages and enjoy travel. And with working with engineers and surveyors, I sort of understood that side of things. And the fact that it was complemented by public health and global health just made the job all that much more appealing. So a little over 2 years later, I'm still with Engineering World Health and absolutely love it and love the impact that we've been able to make through the organization.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Melissa. Tell us about your organization. I'm not sure whether I should say the customers that you serve or whether you refer to them under another name, and the countries in which you work. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Okay. Well, Engineering World Health, I believe, as you mentioned earlier, has been around for about a decade. And we are really one of the very few organizations worldwide that focuses in a very niche market to ensure that students and technicians worldwide receive the training and repair and maintenance skills that they need to repair their own medical equipment in developing country hospitals. Within developing country hospitals, there's an enormous amount of medical equipment that's been donated. Reports from every region indicate that sometimes 80% of the equipment that's donated, either new or old, is not optimally used or may not be functioning at all. As much oftentimes as 39% of the equipment is non-functional upon arrival, and in many, many cases, within 5 years of a donation, only 2% of that equipment is even still working. And that's mostly due to the lack of training, the lack of service manuals, spare parts, accessories, and really a lack of a general skill set for people on the ground to be able to take care, repair, and maintain their own equipment. So that's the group that we address, and that's ultimately the problem that we seek to solve. We really want to ensure that that healthcare and modern healthcare is available to people at all levels of communities in the developing world, and especially within resource-poor settings. So to address that, we have three different strategies. All of them revolve around training with various types of students. We work with university-based students from the West and Europe and in the United States and in several other countries. We also work with local technicians. The technicians with whom we're working are based in Rwanda, Ghana, Cambodia, and Honduras, and they're participating in our BMET program. BMET stands for Biomedical Equipment Technician. We've established, with the help of the GE Foundation, a 3-year training program in each of these countries that will enable local hospital technicians to get the knowledge set, the skill set, and in some cases, literally the tool set that they need in order to do their work.
And we're talking about X-ray machines, heart monitor machines, that perhaps large organizations in the medical and health field donate to Rwanda, Ghana, and so forth, because perhaps they're now out of date, they don't have a functional use for them, and they donate them and they're shipped over there, and then they get there and they don't work, or shortly after being shipped they don't work.
That's absolutely correct. There are a number of different types of organizations that are very well intended that send a variety of types of equipment abroad to developing country hospitals. And you know, in the best case scenario, it's relatively new equipment and it functions well. But even new equipment, just like new cars, are eventually going to break down. And in the absence of a mechanic in the case of a car, or the absence of a technician in the case of medical equipment, there's going to be very little that one can do to repair that equipment. And in some cases, the repairs are quite simple. But in more than 50% of the cases, the repairs are very, very easy. And equipment could be put back into service for as little as $50 or less.
Wow, $50 can help go a long way.
Yes,
really.
Absolutely.
Really? Well, you started talking some numbers, and this is where, as the accountant, I get very excited. We are, I hate to say it, a finance radio show, CFO Radio. So let's get into some of the numbers. What is the financial impact of your programs on the hospitals that you serve and your customer base?
Well, the financial impact of the hospital is an interesting thing to see. Our Summer Institute, which is a student study abroad program that's been operating in Tanzania, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Costa Rica since 2001, is really one of our best cases of fantastic financial impact. The students going into those countries repair everything under the sun, from autoclaves to X-ray machines and anesthesia units and cardiac monitors to suction pumps. And over the past decade, we've sent over 322 students into those countries who have repaired over 3,500 pieces of equipment, and that totals well over $7 million of equipment that has been returned to service. So that's a huge financial impact for the hospitals to have that equipment up and running and functioning in their hospitals at the end of just 1 month spent with the students each summer.
And from the numbers that we talked about earlier, if I recall, was it 66,000 patient lives are saved through this?
Well, and that's actually through our BMET program, which is the slightly different program where we're training local technicians. And that statistic comes out of Rwanda. In Rwanda, we were training, through our very first session, 16 local technicians. And these technicians had skill sets that basically were the equivalent of kindergarten up to 12th grade. Some of them had had very specific equipment repair training. Others had not. But they went through a 2-month training course that we provided in collaboration with Duke University and the GE Foundation. And at the end of that training session, they went back out into their hospitals. We did a very informal survey to ask each of the 16 students how many pieces of equipment they had been able to repair, and they self-reported to have repaired over 350 pieces of equipment, and their directors reported beyond that that those 350 pieces of equipment had impacted 66,000 patient lives.
That's phenomenal.
It is. It truly is. And we've seen similar results in every country in which we've worked. And you know, it's been a wonderful thing to behold, to know that we're reaching that many people through the educational services that we provide.
Well, taking that one step further, I know that when we were talking about the preparation for the show, you talked a little bit about one of the BMET programs that could be measured in other terms, and the importance of developing not only inventories but planned preventive maintenance. And this was something that in these countries that they just simply didn't do.
Right. And that's a very important piece of the financial impact. Through the BMET program, one of the core pieces that we teach is called HTM, or Healthcare Technology Management. And this covers sort of the financial side of the BMET program as well as the policy side. One of the things that we really impress upon our students is that they need to understand that each hospital must have an inventory. And hospital technicians, like probably most of us, don't particularly enjoy doing the paperwork. We'd rather do our jobs than fill out inventories or expense reports or work order forms. But we managed to convince them to do their hospital inventories for really one very important reason. You don't know what you need in terms of new equipment or donated equipment until you know what you have. Once you know what you have, you can also take that and further develop it to know what kind of planned preventive maintenance schedules you should be setting up. And again, I make the analogy to that of a car. If you have a car, you know as part of your planned preventive maintenance for that car, you're going to have the oil changed however many thousand miles, and you're going to get new tires however many thousand miles. And it's the same type of thing for medical equipment. There's certain preventive measures that need to be taken every 1 month or 3 months or 6 months to keep that machine fully functional. So again, by having the inventories, they can tell the equipment that they have and the state or the condition that it's in, so they can begin to plan and prepare for maintenance. And this, in turn, allows the technicians and the hospital directors to make informed decisions about the equipment purchases they need to be making, about the consumables and accessories and supplies that they'll need to perform preventive maintenance, and about the budgetary requests that they'll need to make from the ministries of health each year when they're actually making their budget requests.
Now, in making these budget requests, you've referred to $50 being able to provide some significant help. Do you have any examples of anything that was kind of a low-cost repair that might just be a broad example for us to use?
Oh, absolutely, and this is really one of my favorite stories. Some of our students that were participating in the Summer Institute 1 year noticed in their local hospital that ECG pads were being reused. And the ECG pads are the pads that you stick to your body when your heart rate is being measured and when other tests of that sort are being done. And it's not sanitary for an ECG pad to be reused patient after patient after patient. So again, the students noticed that this was a problem and were sitting around a dinner table, who knows what, one night, and noticed that all of the bottles they were drinking from were glass bottles with metal lids.
This is beer or something like that, right?
I'm sorry?
This is beer or something like that. They were all on a drinking
session. Yeah, there was probably way too much beer involved.
Okay. I've got the picture.
I like to assume that it's Coke, but because I'm very thankful every day that Diet Coke and Coke are worldwide.
Shout out to Coca-Cola there.
But in the case of college students, probably way too much beer was involved, and they sat around flicking out the little metal lid liners that were in the metal bottle caps. I mean, and I know I've played with those things before. Just when I'm fiddling around, I've picked them out and pulled them out. Well, it dawned on them, and it would have never dawned on me, that, wow, these things could be ECG pads. They're exactly the same size. They're exactly the same shape. They're more or less the same texture and consistency. So they tested them out. They, I'm sure, very gratefully drank many more beers to pull out many more bottle caps and cut tiny little slits in them and inserted sewing snaps, which are readily available in the developing world. And then all they had to do was tape those to a person's skin and attach the lead line to an ECG machine, and voila, they had a readily available supply of reusable ECG pads, because these, the metal, the little bottle cap lid liners, actually stand up to being sterilized over and over and over again fairly well. And you know, for anybody that's been to a developing country, you know that unfortunately, the ground and the bars and the restaurants are lined with metal bottle cap lids just ripe for the picking. So they do have that instant supply of those. And I think that's just an ingenious idea of a way to save a hospital money. You know, in other cases, we've heard of students that have reconfigured OR theater lights from Toyota headlight parts. We've had students that have developed uninterruptible power supplies from recycled car battery and computer parts. So they've really done some amazing and very ingenious things that cost much less than $50 and can save that hospital quite a bit of time and money.
And that's obviously the creative and ingenuity of just some smart people that are out there and looking at what resources are around.
Absolutely. You know, for someone of my age group and older, we like to say that they've MacGyvered a solution.
That's right.
When I mention to the students that they're MacGyvering things, they of course have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about.
Understand. Well, there's also another example that I love that you shared with me, Melissa, and this was, I think, a Rwandan hospital to do with an X-ray machine that hadn't been working for quite some time.
Yes, and that was again one of my favorite stories. I was in Rwanda about a year and a half ago and visiting with some of the hospitals and their directors after the technicians had gone through a couple of sessions of training. I went to a hospital near the Congo border and talked to their director, and he couldn't have put the story out there more eloquently if I had actually fed him the words. He was telling about the technician that had attended the training session and had come home, and there was a broken X-ray machine, and you know, there's a lot that you can do to mess up an X-ray machine without much effort. So with good reason, the technician had been very reluctant to try to touch it or do anything with it for fear of making it even worse. But the hospital director promptly reminded the technician, well, I've put you through training. You need to try this now. So the technician mustered up his courage, opened up the X-ray machine, and saw that it was a very simple problem. It was three blown fuses. And you can replace blown fuses in Rwanda even with a great deal of ease. So he replaced the fuses. The X-ray machine was promptly back into service. It was able to see the 25 patients a day that it had been meant to see, which meant that the hospital could quit diverting resources away from equipment and instead to transportation. What was happening is that in the severe cases who were coming to the hospital and couldn't be treated by the X-ray machine, they were transporting them to another hospital between 120 and 200 miles away. So that was costing them a great deal in transportation services that they couldn't use on equipment. And it was also directly impacting the patients, not just in terms of care. Obviously, if you come to a hospital and you need an X-ray, you don't want to be sent away. You don't want to be transported. You want to be diagnosed.
Sure,
so the severe
sure.
cases, again, were being sent away. The simple cases, they were winging it or doing the best they could. But patients were spending a great deal of time waiting, hoping that the X-ray machine would be brought back online and that they would be able to be seen. So while they're waiting, they're not earning their average daily income, which in Rwanda is $1.89 a day. And while they're not earning that income, they're not spending that income in their communities. So the trickle-down effect of one equipment repair from three simple blown fuses, which is more or less a $10 to $30 solution, has this enormous impact on the hospital budget and on the community's ability to function by staying in their jobs and not having to wait at the hospital and by being able to spend the money that they would typically earn and so on and so forth. And I think it's just a great demonstration of how one simple repair can have such an amazing and trickle-down effect.
Sure. Well, at this stage, what I would like to ask you to do, Melissa, is to do a little bit of a shout out for your website. And there may be listeners, and we are listened to on three different continents. There may
Wonderful.
Be listeners that are inspired to call you, to contact you, perhaps by the internet. We'll do this shout out again at the end of the radio show. But how can people get in touch with you if they want to?
Our internet website is www.ewh.org, and all of the information about our programs, the Summer Institute, the BMET program, and our student programs is available on the website, as well as information on how to contribute to Engineering World Health.
Great. So if somebody wants to be a volunteer and or to be part of the organization, there's a place for them to go. And then if somebody wants to potentially donate $30, $50 or $30,000, $50,000 or maybe even more, they can do that online too, huh?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Well, let's talk a little bit about the finance aspect. I know that you work very, very closely with your treasurer, who unfortunately couldn't be with us today, and I hope her and her family are doing well. There's some family illness that she's focused upon. You work very closely with your treasurer, and part of what your focus is to look at low-cost and low-tech solutions that can help, because you're often going into very poor resource settings. There may or may not be electricity. There may or may not be permanent electricity. And then you work with engineering students in the U.S. How do you do that?
We have established over time a network of over 40 university-based chapters in the U.S., Europe, and the Middle East, as well as in Mexico. And these chapters are made up of engineering students of all varieties, biomedical engineers as well as electrical, chemical, and mechanical engineers. And they come together. One of the things that they do is they look at our Projects That Matter list. Our Projects That Matter list is posted on our website, and it's informed each year by the students that participate in the Summer Institute. Those students come back and tell stories about needs that they've identified that they believe can be met in low-tech, low-cost ways. Again, chapters often develop or adopt those ideas and work on them as a group, you know, over a period of years. Some of the best of those ideas have gone on to become design competition entries. Others have become senior design and capstone projects. And in the case of Photogenesis with the Billy Lights and Waste to Watts with the Uninterruptible Power Supplies, they've actually formed their own companies.
And that was how you and I were introduced. It was actually through one of the founders of Waste to Watts, who was a guest on our radio show about four or five months ago. They had been part of your outreach abroad.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of a shout out, because I think this is a wonderful example of technology and just quite simply some smart individuals that are doing a wonderful thing for the world.
Right, absolutely. And the Waste to Watts group has been, you know, really the model of what we'd like to see happen. The guys that got involved with that group, Chris Hammond and James Mullaney, were both Summer Institute participants. And they clearly identified with the needs in the developing countries. They saw that electricity is unreliable. There are brownouts and blackouts on a daily basis, and that's a particular problem if you're in the middle of an operation, as I'm sure you can imagine. You don't want whatever monitor it is that's monitoring you to suddenly die with the power, or you don't want the anesthesia machine to die along with the power. So they really zeroed in on a need for an uninterruptible power supply and put all of their heart and significant intelligence into developing that, and worked with our summer institutes in more recent years to help field test that piece of equipment. They've done a wonderful job of entering into business plan competitions and winning those. And I honestly don't know when they sleep. I think they're working at it morning, noon, and night. I'd have to say, based on their pictures on Facebook, though, they're getting to see some pretty cool places as a result of all their work. But you know, that is exactly what we'd like to see happen. They came up with the idea. They worked with their chapter. They developed this group and this small nonprofit together as a group of individuals. They continued to promote the idea and follow the idea, actually, while Chris even worked for Engineering World Health for a while. And then they were having such success with it that they went for profit and are carrying it on into manufacturing and distribution in developing countries. We couldn't be more proud that something like that has happened, and we hope that other design competition teams will follow suit. They've truly been the model of what we would like to see.
And what I love about Chris and Cameron and his team's story is that when they were out, I think initially in, was it Rwanda?
They were in Tanzania.
Tanzania, sorry. They essentially found that the needs, the resources to be able to help those failing situations that were in the hospitals with the hospital equipment was right beside them, mm-hmm. in that they found car and truck batteries that were essentially abandoned, and the cars and the trucks that removed the battery from the vehicle, and because of the acidity and so forth, and the damage that could be done from that. And they saw those outages, and I guess maybe there were a couple of, let's say, Coca-Colas involved one evening, and one of them said to the other, hey, you know, I think if we could, you know, get a couple of pieces of wire and do this and do that. And they obviously had their PhD hats on. They're from Georgia Tech University, and yeah. I think Duke University as well. And they figured out a way to make the batteries provide enough power source to be able to help the failing hospitals that were a mile down the road.
Yeah, and that's really the remarkable thing about what a lot of our students do, and really part of what we're trying to teach the technicians that we're teaching even through the BMET program is, in so many cases, everything that you need to make the repair or to come up with a new type of repair is sitting right around you. And you have to be able to really think. I hate using the term think outside of the box, but that's really what they're doing, is they're thinking of new, creative, and innovative ways to solve a solution with, you know, really readily available resources that you might not think of. And I never cease to be impressed by it. I'm not an engineer. So when I see these things, I just can't help but sit back and think, wow, I just would never, ever dream that up. But it really is remarkable what they come up with. Another great example, last year there was a girl at a Tanzanian hospital, and you could tell she had a particular affinity for the infant ward. I think she spent every moment of her free time in there playing with the babies and helping the nurses with the babies. And she, like so many students before her, identified the need for Billy lights, which, again, help children with jaundice. A lot of our students do secondary projects, so she and her partner in that hospital decided that they would develop another Billy light so that the nursery could have several of them. And I love the way they did it. They measured a crib and basically took PVC piping and made more or less a little tent or platform over the crib. And they lined it with a shower curtain and then took the rope Christmas lighting, like we in the States here see all the time at Christmas, that everybody wraps around their trees and their decks and so on and so forth. Well, they took that and wrapped it under the underside of the shower curtain and around the PVC piping so they could place it in the crib. And that would enable the nurses to place three or four infants under those blue lights to get the treatment that they needed for jaundice. And so that was three or four more infants that could be helped, again, for less than $50.
And it was that simple.
Yeah, that simple. And I'd never come up with it, but, you know, blue Christmas lights and some PVC piping and a shower curtain, and there you go.
There you go. Well, one of the things that I think is so fabulous about your programs for the students and the KITS program that I've been reading up on, students are exposed for the first time to what I love, the mathematics, the science, yeah, behind what it is in your engineering world health. It's an engineering project. And so they're taking on the numbers side of the components, mathematics, science, and they're really taking it to the next level.
Oh, absolutely. For many of the students that participate in our chapters and in any of our programs, they are learning the math and science behind all of the medical devices in a very hands-on, practical way that gets them beyond the theory that they're taught in the classroom. And for many of them, it's their first hands-on experience. We've been very fortunate that over the past several years, kits have been developed that can be used in the developing world. And what I mean by a kit is, for example, years ago, students identified the need for a low-cost ESU tester. Well, an ESU tester is an electrosurgery unit. An electrosurgery unit is the modern-day scalpel where you're not just cutting into human flesh with a knife, but with a knife that can simultaneously cauterize as it cuts. And you have to guarantee that it's calibrated and working at an appropriate output level so that you're not burning the flesh as you cut it or hurting the tissue in some way. So this little kit that's been developed looks like nothing more really than a little black deck of playing cards, but it's made up of a circuit board and resistors and diodes and so on and so forth. And once you push the tip of the electrosurgery unit against it, once the kit is complete, it can tell you whether or not that device is working at the appropriate level. Well, students designed that. And now today, students, volunteers assemble those for us free of charge so that we can provide them to our partner hospitals. Those devices cost an absolute maximum of $20. The ESU testing device that we have in our office, which we can use for quality control purposes, is used, and it was a $2,500 piece of equipment. So a $20 device in a developing country hospital versus a $2,500 device, you can do the math and see which one's a bit more cost efficient.
Sure.
And, you know, it's again, things like that that we're really excited about, being able to teach them not only the math and science behind it, but provide them with the hands-on activities. We've been really excited recently to become involved with middle and high school groups as well as Girl Scouts. We attended a conference in New York back in September called Maker Faire. That's an enormous do-it-yourself type conference with lots of science booths and math booths and activities. And really, much to our surprise, we were a hit. We had an enormous number of parents and younger students and teachers coming by our booth to express an interest in what we were doing. So upon our return back to North Carolina, we started to look into STEM education, which is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and have begun work with several partners through North Carolina State University, Duke University, and the Shodor Foundation to not only create curriculum for students that could help them understand at a middle and high school level the math and science behind these projects in a global health context, but also to develop that curriculum for educators so that they can learn how to teach their students, in some cases even in after-school programs, about those components and about the kits and, again, their math and science aspects in a global health context.
That's fabulous. Well, let's talk a little bit about taking on the maths. Let's kind of internalize that with you and EWH. What do you consider to be the return on investment or ROI for those who might be considering donating to your organization?
Well, I'm very proud to be able to say that for anybody that considers donating, over 80 cents out of every dollar that we raise goes directly to programmatic support. So I'm very happy that we can say that we have very low overhead costs. Beyond that, I think the return on investment through our programs is absolutely enormous. Again, when you look at the example of 16 students that received training in Rwanda, returning within 1 month enough equipment to impact 66,000 patient lives, that demonstrates an enormous, slightly less tangible return on investment. But also through our Summer Institute, I think it's slightly more easily calculated. It costs EWH about $6,500 to send a student on the Summer Institute. And we've calculated that about each student repairs about $20,000 worth of equipment each summer.
So immediately there is an ROI for that program.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're getting $20,000 worth of repairs for $6,500. So that, again, is an immediate ROA. If you really want to extrapolate it out and imagine what that would cost were a professional engineer doing that work as opposed to a student, your return on investment increases significantly. But those are sort of two different streams there. But the students make, you know, they're much less tangible returns on investment as well in terms of the fact that the students walk away with such confidence. A hugely increased skill set because they receive very specific training about how to work on medical devices within the constraints of the developing world. So they come back much more prepared to take on the tasks in the classroom and to serve as more globally in tune employees for future employers. But they also walk away, and this is the perspective that I really like, they walk away as more confident leaders. I see the students before the program and after the program, and, you know, as you can imagine, before the program, they're a bit shy. They're not quite sure what it is they've just jumped into. I know when I studied abroad in Paris, which, you know, really wasn't a big difference. I can't imagine having studied abroad for 2 months in Africa with limited clean water and limited electricity and limited Wi-Fi and all of those sorts of things so far from home. But they go away a little shy, and they come back just oozing enthusiasm.
That's fabulous.
They're very proud of themselves for the accomplishments that they've made. And, you know, you really create a lifelong philanthropist and a lifelong global citizen by giving them this exposure. So it goes well beyond the fact that a $65 investment results in at least $20,000 worth of repairs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, what? Let's talk a little bit about some of the strategic elements of EWH. One thing that I love when we're able to talk with the leaders of an organization is that we can talk about the success, but as any organization faces its growth or its just survival mode, there may be struggles. What kind of struggles does EWH face, perhaps as a nonprofit and beyond that as a business?
Well, one of the interesting struggles that we deal with is, to be perfectly honest, we're not a sexy organization. When you talk about medical devices, you know, that's not something that people readily identify with. I think other organizations have a much greater ability to put a face on what they do than perhaps EWH does. I know before I took this particular role 2 years ago, I never thought at all about the role that medical equipment played in the ability of doctors and nurses working in underdeveloped countries to be able to do their jobs. And I don't think most people think about that. And we're also in a very niche market. The blessing and the curse about EWH is we're really the only game in town doing what we do. We are the largest organization worldwide donated or focused on the repair, maintenance, and training of post-donation medical equipment. So that makes us very unique. And again, that's a blessing and a curse. There's nobody else out there doing what we're doing, so it's very hard to learn from others and to keep from reinventing the wheel, so to speak. But again, it's, you know, equipment not particularly sexy. We have found ways to make it much more interesting by telling the stories that I've just told and relating them to a very human face, relating them to lives saved. You know, it's, again, a great example. It's hard to imagine babies dying of hypothermia in Africa, but up around Mount Kilimanjaro, I'm here to tell you, it gets pretty cold, and at least every other year we see infants dying because they don't have access to incubators or infant warmers or even warm rooms, and our students and our engineers can help prevent those problems. So that's the human face that we try to put on it. Every nonprofit, and ours included, faces the struggles with raising funds and raising awareness, and we're certainly not alone in that need. So one of the things that we're constantly trying to do is increase our exposure and our recognition and do so in a way that will allow us to, you know, scale up and tackle the enormous need that exists with limited monetary resources as well as limited staff resources.
Sure, and that is a challenge of many organizations, but particularly nonprofits.
Yes, absolutely. And it's very important also that we think about smart growth. When I joined the organization in November of 2009, it was in some ways a lot easier than it is today. It was myself and one other young man in the office, and we were running it all. Today we have 16 staff worldwide. We've more than doubled our budget, and it's, you know, we've gone from 4 countries into 7, and we've expanded our reach and the depth and breadth of what we do and the services that we can provide, not only through the Summer Institute and the BMET program, but also through our summer program or through our student programs. So it's very exciting that we've done all that, and we've got a wonderful staff that are thoroughly committed to the mission and a wonderful board that's thoroughly committed to the mission. But it's a lot of growth in a short period of time, and we want to be able to keep up that pace. We want to meet the need.
Understand. And as a reminder to our listeners of the radio show, how do they reach your organization again?
Our website is www.ewh.org. And there's a lot of great information about the organization on the website. There are 2 wonderful videos about the Summer Institute and the BMET program, as well as some snippets of interviews from students in last year's Summer Institute that speak directly to their experiences. And, of course, there's a donate page, so we'd be happy to accept your donations.
Great. Well, we have a tradition on our radio show, Melissa, and I'm going to give you a one-time punch. We've got a tradition on our radio show to ask our guests, what is your CFO tip of the month? From the role of CEO and executive director managing a nonprofit organization, what is your tip of the month?
Oh, I would have to say run your mouth constantly. Talk to everybody. Tell your story everywhere, every day, and in every manner, and just get the word out. All of my staff are engineers, but they also wear their PR hats, and I think the most important thing to do is just keep promoting what you're doing and spreading the word, and that's my tip of the month. I saw it pay off actually earlier this week. I was running my mouth in Starbucks over a meeting, and a doctor was actually sitting right behind me and got up and introduced herself and wanted to find out about work that we're looking at doing in Haiti. So it pays off to keep just promoting your story and telling it over and over and over again. You never know who's listening.
And I will also say that we've made some nice shout-outs to some very big publicly held corporations. And since you said them, I'm going to do another shout-out because I think it's a great tip to the Coca-Cola drinkers of the world, to the Toyota drivers of the world, and to the Starbucks drinkers of the world, because they're all helped you in one manner or other. And there's probably
Absolutely.
A beer company we should be thanking as well, but not sure about that, right? Well, thanks very much to you, Melissa Beard, for being our guest today. It's been a pleasure having you. It's been a pleasure learning about your organization and certainly the finance aspects of how to manage the international complexities of what you do. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you, Lorraine. It's been a pleasure being here.
Wonderful. And thanks also to our contributor for the article and CFO.com. Thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks go to our National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or you know of one that might like to be a guest on the radio show today, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.